I'm Gab, he's Rubbo, filling in for Jules today. Blue skies and some rain, a bit mixed over West London today. I know that's why you all tune in for the weather report. But what a show we have. We'll be talking playoffs. The last three teams for Euro 2024 have been confirmed. But let's start with Brazil against Spain. And I know we talked about, I talked about Brazil with Jules on Monday. But this was a 3-3 draw. This did not feel like a friendly at all. Dorival, the Brazil coach, says, oh, I'm going to play my same 11. Like, I have no reason to go and rotate, keep clubs happy. I want to find out what I have, which makes sense. It's only a second game in charge. And the result was a game that had a ton of incident and some moments of real skill.
Yeah, and Brazil were outplayed in the first 20 minutes. Spain had all the play. It looked like they were going to score more than just the two goals that they got. Olmo was playing brilliantly. Yamal was magnificent on the right wing. Nico Williams played one of the best first half I've seen him play for a little while. Morata still inconsistent at times, but there was a time when Spain looked as they were going to completely dominate the game against Brazil.
Yeah, and then Unai Simon kind of gifted them a goal, and then they got back into it. Endrick scoring with his first touch.
Yeah,
Can you just walk me through that a little bit? Because I think it comes off it's off of a corner kick. The ball goes back out, but it just literally looks like he's just standing there, and he just kind of swings his leg. All right, there was a deflection, but still, like, it's difficult to do technically, right?
It's fairly difficult, but the fact that the ball was coming to him quite quickly, he only has to make decent contact for the ball to go back very quickly.
You know? But wouldn't you have side-footed it? Wouldn't most people have side-footed it?
I don't think so. I think the way it came, I think you would go with your laces and try and hit it as hard as you can. The skill is keeping it down, which he did, and it took a slight deflection. And I would also say that Unai Simon, he was at fault for the first goal. I think he could have done a little bit better for that one as well. But it was a good strike, and obviously a top talented player.
All right, there was a lot of acrimony in this game at the end. And before it, obviously, we've talked about Vinicius often being racially abused by opposing fans. Others saying that Vinicius actually, I don't want to say brings it upon himself, but he is going to be a figure of hate. And if you are a figure of hate because of the way you play the game, which involves often losing your cool, remonstrating with a referee, pushing opponents off the ball. We've seen him do all these things. There are some people out there who will feel totally wrongly and incorrectly empowered to then abuse you. And what happened in this game, there was no racist abuse as far as has been reported, but there were a lot of players, including some of his Real Madrid teammates, kind of getting in his face and saying, you're not helping with your behavior. And this comes a few days after, you know, he gave that emotional interview where he was, you know, he fought back tears and he says, I just want to play. And he complained about the racist abuse he got.
I fully agree with you. You know, nothing excuses racist abuse to a player. And you can't say he brings it on himself, but what he does, he plays the game in a way that many people don't like, including me. When I'm commentating on him, I get frustrated the fact that he's thrown himself to the ground in the very first minute, remonstrating with the referee, remonstrating with his opponent, then pushing and shoving the opponent, then trying to whip up the crowd. I don't think he is helping himself, you know, and I know he's a very good friend of yours, but Ancelotti, I think, defends him a little bit too much. And I think at some point he's got to try and curb the way he plays the game. Does all that make him play better? Some people would say it does. It inspires him to play better because he's a fantastic footballer. But I think if he concentrates on his football and doesn't get involved in all the other stuff, he would be a world-class player. There's no doubt about it.
Well, I'd argue he is a world-class player now, personally. But the racist abuse part, when it does happen, complicates the whole.
Of course,
complicates the whole matter, and it's really difficult, I think, to beyond saying, like, the minute this happens, whoever's responsible needs to be punished. And La Liga I don't think they've gone far enough. I think they've shown more of an interest recently. We need to see the follow through, right? But you're absolutely right. The reactions, I mean, we saw two consecutive games where he went and he shoved an opponent. Even in this game, at one point, he goes and he just shoves Lamine Yamal to the ground. You can't do that And at some point, it will come back to bite you, because at some point, either an opponent will hurt you or the referee will, more simply, send you off.
Well, the game against Leipzig was a great example.
With Willy Orban, absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, there was no reason for him to do that. You know, Willy Orban tried to make the most of it and said he was pushed in the face when it was actually his neck and his chest. But why do it? So there's something not quite right with his behaviour on a football field.
Robert, what we saw in reaction from some portions of the Spanish media and pundits is this idea, and you use the word, but use the term before, not in that way, that it's not racism, it's Vinicius, right? This is what some people have put out there, including people like, I saw an interview with Donato, who you may remember, former Atletico Madrid and Deportivo La Coruña, who's actually, he's Brazilian, who is a person of color, ended up playing for Spain, ended up playing, he was very old, and, you know, he came out and he said, well, yeah, I used to get it too, but, you know, you just move on and you don't react that way because it doesn't help. And I think the world has changed since Donato played.
Yes.
And if I were Vinicius, I would get annoyed and saying, hey, you old guys, you know, this isn't 1995 anymore, right? However, at the same time, I think the sad thing about this is when you have a game like this, it ends in so much acrimony with, you know, we saw Joselu getting in his face, we saw Rodri, we saw Emerick Laporte afterwards came out and basically mocked him, where, you know, because he came out like I just want to play, and then like he's like, you know, I just want to behave like this. You get a situation where there's going to be a portion of morons who are going to say, if he didn't behave like this, he wouldn't get racially abused. Which is, to me, is a little bit like, oh, well, if she didn't wear a short skirt, she wouldn't get sexually assaulted, right? We have to separate those
two things. There's still no excuse for racially abusing a player, whether he behaves poorly on the field or not. You can't do that. But you can see why people don't like the way he acts on the football field. You can see why he would get stick. It shouldn't be racistic.
And you can see why he's probably so unpopular, I think, with opponents and also with teammates. Now, out of Sergio Ramos, who, you know, people have brought him up as obviously a different player, Sergio Ramos, you know. So I was going to say, like, oh, he never ran at players on the wing and beat them. He used to do that, actually, when he was very, very young. We just remember old Sergio Ramos. But he's another guy who would wind people up, would, you know, people in this country call it dark arts. So there have been many through the years. And it feels like maybe Sergio Ramos didn't get the stick. So are we using, is there a double standard there between Sergio Ramos and Vinicius, for example, when we condemn the behavior on the pitch?
To a certain degree. But I think it was last year when Vinicius started playing really well and started play-acting a little bit and started to cause one or two problems on the field and not behaving the way I think he should behave. And I likened him a little bit to Neymar, because Neymar is not a popular character, I wouldn't say. When a lot of people who watch Neymar or watch Messi, everybody loves Messi because he gets up and gets on with it and goes past people and doesn't moan too much, doesn't gesticulate, not very often, with the referee and opponents, whereas Neymar did and tried to roll around on the floor. If he's not careful, Vinicius Jr. will be exactly the same as Neymar. And then we won't be talking about his talent, we'll be talking about his reactions to things.
Right.
Because, as you said, he's a world-class player. He could be the best player in the world at some point. But he's got to make sure he behaves himself and acts in a totally different way. And that's where Ancelotti's got to try and teach him and teach him and teach him. And say, forget all the other stuff. You've got to become the world's best player. And you're only going to do that if you forget all the other antics that go along with it.
I can't speak for Ancelotti, obviously, but I wonder if maybe that might come to a head a little bit next season. Because look, this season, you look at Real Madrid's forwards, and you need Vinicius, and you need Vinicius to be central, right? Because there's nobody else other than Rodrigo and Joselu. Next season, if Endrick comes, if Mbappe comes, all of a sudden, you have options in how you sort of run the group. You're going to have to make a big call about, yeah, the Mbappe deal's not done, and maybe he won't come. But if he does come, where do you put Mbappe? Given do you put Mbappe through the middle?
Because even if you put Mbappe through the middle, what does he like doing? He'll drift to the left hand side. Exactly what Vinicius Junior was doing.
We've seen Vinicius this season, and I think it's a credit to his hard work and I think to his intelligence that we've seen him adapt in that front too. We've seen him even, you know, hold the ball up, do things that you know, for a guy who was born as a winger, don't necessarily come naturally. I think he's grown a lot in that perspective. So maybe Ancelotti's imagining a front two. Maybe he's imagining some hybrid system where they take turns through the middle. I don't know what he's thinking. But all of a sudden, the numbers are going to be such that I don't know that Vinicius is going to get the all-out protection when there will be a bigger dog in town in Mbappe. And when all of a sudden, if he starts getting himself sent off or booked or suspended, or there's always chaos and drama around it, coaches don't like that, do they?
No, they don't, because that's not something. While you're winning football games, and Real Madrid have been winning football games this year, it doesn't really matter so much. But if you start losing games and other players saying, come on, get a grip of him because he's causing us a problem, it's getting the crowd wound up, the crowd now against us, you know, it's causing us a problem on the football field, then players, as Benzema did when he was at the club, he didn't like some of the things that Vinicius was doing. That was when he hadn't really reached his potential. So Ancelotti's got a big job to do. What I would say about Vinicius Jr. this season is that we'll see what he's capable of on the ball. I've been really impressed by his movement, you know, particularly as you just said, when he was playing in the centre forward position, he comes short and spins in behind. Sure. Sometimes you don't see that because the ball doesn't go, but his movement off the ball shows great intelligence and a willingness to make those forward runs.
Yeah, that's something that often gets overlooked because people just talk about his speed and athleticism and whatever. But I think he's become a really, really intelligent player. He's taken on more of that responsibility. He's even done more work off the ball. Ancelotti often doesn't ask him to do work off the ball because we like to have the out ball to Vinicius, but when it's there, you know, he goes and does it. So I just think if you just cut out this thing with pushing lesser opponents, with winding, with you know, then or you find a way to do it in a way that's maybe more subtle. I mean, I don't all forwards, I don't want to go all Ale Moreno here, but all strikers will get cute if they can win a foul, right?
Yeah, of course.
Or almost all of them. There's a way to do it without raising the tension in the game, without making the referee not like you, without winding up the opponent, right?
Yeah.
And I think that's where he needs to make the breakthrough.
Yeah.
Basic storyline here, it's too easy to ignore. Endrick and Lamine Yamal. These guys weren't even born when the Lionel Messi, Cristiano Ronaldo rivalry started to grow. I thought Lamine Yamal was phenomenal. Oh. With Endrick, obviously spends less time on the pitch, but I'm just struck by how unfazed this man is between the England game and this one. What's your take?
Absolutely. I mean, start on Yamal. I've watched him a lot for Barcelona over the course of the last season. And you're just shocked by his ability to go past people, his ability to read the game, the ability to decide when to run past people, when to chop it back onto his left foot and play little one-twos, when to play a pass. Just is so mature for a player so young, and a great athlete as well. And he's not going to be a player that, you know, be unkind to Michael Owen, a young player that came onto the scene and scored goals, great goals, and was a top class player for England. He relied solely on his pace. Yamal has got great skill, great vision, great awareness, and pace to match as well. So he's going to be a top-class player. And I think that probably, I haven't seen quite as much of him, but Endrick's going to be exactly the same. You know, he's a player that has a football intelligence, pace, ability to go past people, everything you want from a top-class player.
Do you see him more as a winger or through the middle?
He's
a strong boy.
I would see him to start with as a wide player and then grow into a centre-forward. And as we're seeing now, there's lots of, like, most forwards like to be hybrid centre-forwards where they can go through the middle or go wide. We see it with Mbappe, we see it with Vinicius Jr. now, we see it with Rodrigo to a certain degree. Even when Ronaldo was playing at his very best, he still, even when he was at centre-forward, he'd drift out to the left wing, and when he was left wing, he'd drift into the centre-forward position. Right. So I think you need to be a player that can go wide or play through the middle, which I'm sure both those players can.
All right, a word on Spain. Because when I saw that lineup, I mean, he made a bunch of changes compared to the game at the weekend. And when I saw that, I thought, okay, this is interesting because, you know, Nico Williams, Dani Olmo, and Lamine Yamal, right? So you've got the 16-year-old phenom, who I assumed was only going to play 45 minutes because Barcelona, but no, he played the whole game, which kind of surprised me.
Yeah.
Dani Olmo, who has been injured so much, just really hasn't played. And Nico Williams, who, I'm going to say this, he's not somebody, certainly you wouldn't associate him with the Luis Enrique regime and even with De La Fuente because he's just such a direct player, right? And yet they looked really, really good.
Yeah.
That worked. And I find it interesting because obviously in a perfect world with Gavi and Pedri available and whatnot, those guys might not be on the pitch, or some of them wouldn't.
Yeah. I mean, Nico Williams, I think you're absolutely right. When I've seen Nico Williams play, I think he's a direct player, can be inconsistent at times, doesn't always get the final pass right, but he played well in that role on the left-hand side, chopping in onto his right foot. So he showed he could go past people down the outside, but also come in on his right foot and play crosses or play little one-twos. Olmo, as well as I've seen him play for quite some while, I know he's had lots of injuries, but ever since I saw him in the under-21s, I think it was in Poland when Spain won the competition a few years ago, I was kept on looking at him and thinking, come on, show me what I saw in those under-21 games. I never really saw it, even when, you know, I do a lot of Leipzig games. And being disappointed,
I don't think he features very big in Leipzig's plans either.
And then suddenly I saw more quality the other night, you know, whether it was a one-off game or whether he has got that ability in him. But it was a much better performance from him.
Right. Do we still have Brazil as favourites for the Copa America? Or do you put them, or do you put the world champions ahead of them?
With a front line of Vinicius Jr., Rodrigo and Rafinha, who played the other night, they're a side that are going to counter-attack, and they'll counter-attack very well. Are they good enough defensively? They've got one or two issues there, but I would still put them as favourites to win it.
And in Europe, how far down the pecking order do you... I'm assuming Spain aren't favourites, but
no.
I have them high up. I mean, I think I have them top three.
Yes.
Where do you have them?
Yeah, I would agree, top three, again.
Behind France and England?
Behind France and England. I know France didn't play particularly well over the course of the last few days, and England didn't get great results, but these friendlies, you can't always judge what the teams are going to be. Spain, I think, have a slightly more direct style of play than they've had previously. So they're trying to combine possession football with a bit more penetration, which is a good thing. Have they got the players, the very top players? Will Gavi and Pedri be fully fit?
They won't.
I think that's a problem.
And I think also defensively.
Yeah.
You know, at centre back. Or
Lenormand playing at centre back alongside.
Or even Laporte.
Yeah, Laporte. That doesn't inspire me.
Nor does Unai Simon if it keeps going like this.
No, true. I would put Spain probably third or fourth.
Yeah, I think everybody's got. We can pick a ton of flaws. I think if you look hard enough, you find flaw with any team.
Yeah.
I think England and France probably have fewer flaws.
Yeah.
Although some might say the two managers might have a flaw. But the others all have flaws. But if you get hot in the tournament, then all that goes out the window.
Yeah.
All right, Robert, let's talk playoffs. Because, you know, when they expanded the Euros to 24 teams, for many people, qualifying had been a foregone conclusion, and as a neutral, you weren't quite into it. Now you've had these playoffs involving 12 more teams for the final three spots. I thought this actually got me kind of excited for the Euros, because in terms of tension, in terms of drama, I thought they delivered in all three.
And what I liked is the fact that they weren't two-legged. That was the great thing about it. You've won that game, you're through to the next
yeah phase. One leg, you have an advantage to the home team, we're ranked higher. We saw Poland go to Cardiff and advance past Wales on penalties in what was very tight, and I think both teams could have won it before that. We had Georgia beating Greece on penalties as well.
Feisty game as well.
A really, really feisty game. And we had Ukraine coming from behind to beat Iceland after going a goal down with your boy Mikhailo Mudryk, again, the difference maker.
Yes. Good finish.
Feels weird saying that. What do we expect from these teams? I genuinely think, okay, Georgia may be slightly different because, let's face it, other than Kvaratskhelia and Mamardashvili, like, you don't have too many big household names. I'm sure there's somebody I'm forgetting, and you'll tell me on social media. But Poland and Ukraine have the individuals.
Yeah. I mean, the person who scored the first goal for Ukraine, Sikankov, who's done really well for Girona over the course of the last season. He's a player that everyone was talking about when he was 18, when he first got into the Dynamo Kiev side, and he was in the Ukraine team. Never really fulfilled his potential, but he can be a top-class player on the right-hand side, not coming in on his left foot. So there's a player to look out for. He's done really well at Girona this season. And I thought over the course of the game, although Iceland did have their chances, I think Ukraine did enough to win the game.
Wales, they tried to gut it out as much as they could. They did create the chances. Mm-hmm. Poland, I think this is still a slightly dysfunctional Poland yes. team that's really not as good as mm-hmm. the sum of their parts.
Yeah.
In the end, though, it came down to penalties, mm-hmm. which I think tells you something, that how this really could have gone either way.
It could have done. I mean, obviously, Wales, by their team selection with Kiefer Moore playing as the centre forward, you knew exactly what their tactics were going to be. They got the ball wide. Watching all the highlights over and over again, most of the chances that came in the game were all from crosses into the box or free kicks and players winning balls in the air.
Ben Davies had a goal disallowed for
yep.
really, really close.
Yeah, just offside. But there was no real free-flowing football. They weren't trying to play through the opposition. It was a bit dysfunctional, but crosses coming into the box, that was how the game was going to be won. And neither side could find that end product.
Yeah, I mean, you talk about free-flowing. I mean, Aaron Ramsey, Gareth Bale, Joe Allen, all those guys in midfield are gone.
Yeah.
In the end, if you have, you know, Brennan Johnson, Daniel James, fast players, it makes sense to play
absolutely.
That way, right?
Yeah, of course. And they've got a centre forward who's good in the air. And they looked at the Polish centre half and thought, well, we could probably get a joy out of them. And he did have a bit of joy. He just couldn't score.
Georgia beating Greece now. Okay, Greece fans, I always have a soft spot for the Greeks. I will always support them unless they're playing certain countries, simply because they are cousins. However, part of me said, I'm happy with either one of these teams because I want to see Kvitsa Kvaratskhelia at the Euros. This has been a much more inconsistent season for him than last year.
I think that you could say that about Napoli in general.
Right.
Of course.
But you know, somebody like Osimhen, for example, hasn't been as inconsistent, I think, as Kvaratskhelia. He's got the contractual issue in the background. He's still on the kind of contract that you get if you come from Dinamo Batumi, which should be worked on. But, of course, he signed a long deal, so the club have the leverage. I don't know that he necessarily bossed this game, and I thought Greece had a good game plan to stop him. But how do we feel about him a year after getting so excited and thinking he was a top 10 player?
Yeah.
And he's still young.
Yeah.
Can this be his tournament on a team like this, which kind of essentially puts all the onus on him?
It's going to be difficult for him because they're going to be outplayed in maybe one or two of the games. So difficult for him to get good possession. I think he'd be given a free role rather than play wide on the left-hand side. I think he'd come in field at times. He'll almost play as the second centre forward. He'll go to the other side of the field. In this game, he was all over the place. But he's somebody that can run with the ball. And if you've got pace and you can run with the ball, you can excite any game or illuminate any game, and you can go past people and change the course of a game in one great run, which he did for Napoli on numerous occasions last year. So I'm hoping he has a good tournament. I hope we see the very best of him, and he scores one or two goals as well.
There you go. Hey, for all the people who are like dilution of quality, blah blah blah, there's reasons to watch this tournament. There's compelling stories. There's superstars. Kvaratskhelia with Georgia, Lewandowski, not just him, with Poland. Ukraine, you've got Mudryk, Chigankov, you've got a whole bunch of people and a tremendous storyline. Sit back and enjoy the Euros and stop moaning about dilution of the nonsense. All right, enough playoffs. How about some quick hits instead?
Let's go, Gab.
Jude Bellingham scores in injury time as England and Belgium draw 2-2 in a friendly at Wembley under the driving rain. I was very happy that I was not there. Robbo, what did you learn?
That England might have a slight problem in central midfield and how they're going to play their midfield. Obviously, at the moment, Southgate's going to doing exactly what Ancelotti's doing, playing Bellingham as the main midfield player going forward. Who are they going to play alongside Rice? Maynou played quite well, but is he going to be the player? Is Gallagher going to be the player?
So Calvin Phillips will be
Calvin fit. Phillips certainly won't be part of it. I think they could probably just change the system slightly, and central defence is another problem for England, but they're a good team at the moment.
Is it numbers in central defence, right? It's a numbers game. I mean, honestly, like, Stones, obviously, that struggled the other day. Like, yeah. But obviously, he's very good. But yeah. Then beyond that, you get into McGuire gets hurt.
Yeah.
Like, Louis Tonk doesn't really get people excited. Levi Colwill's injured, in and out, left back. You know, what?
So that's the problem for England, those two positions.
Obviously. And by the way, how about that Lukaku cross with the
great outside of his
boot? The outside of his boot.
Oh, magnificent. Oh, come on. Tielemans coming at the right time.
Respect.
Mind you, you weren't at Wembley because you were in Frankfurt to witness Germany's 2-1 win over the Netherlands. Did you like what you saw from Nagelsmann's men?
So again, they conceded a goal really early on a defensive mistake. All right, first of all, Haaland, I don't want to sound like Jules and talk about the Dutch guy, but it was absolutely horrible. He basically plays a back five, which is essentially a back seven, with Reinders tasked with booting the ball for Depay and Malen to do something. And it's just not a good performance. It's not easy to play against that. But yeah, they just do this thing with Kroos and Gundogan. It's interesting. I think Germany are not getting carried away. They're just kind of enjoying the ride. I think their official song for the Euros is going to be the, you know, Major Tom. The Philip. No, I'm totally serious.
Yeah.
They play that after the goals, and I'm like, well, this is a little weird. But they're all acting.
Havertz at centre forward.
That works fine for me. Cool. Obviously, look, I think what we see, people always said Nagelsmann was arrogant, blah, 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 and like reinvented the wheel. He didn't. It's a bog standard, 4-2-3-1. They don't press much because obviously with Kroos and Gundogan, you can't really do that. The Musiala and Verts, or your wingers, actually come inside all the time, which suits them because it's the type of players they are. He's playing to his players' strengths. He's being very pragmatic. And the other thing that which he does, Andrich and Mittelstadt, these two guys who he's brought into the team, Mittelstadt was 27, he was relegated with Hertha last year, kind of in and out of the team this season at Stuttgart. Andrich as well, only 10 starts this year for Leverkusen. He's not a regular there, but they fill a role. Andrich is a scary guy who looks like a bouncer, who does all the running in midfield. Mittelstadt's the little left-footed guy who goes up and down, scored a goal as well.
Yeah, great goal.
So it kind of works. I don't know how good they're going to be, but, you know, they're just going along.
Good.
France bounced back from their defeat to Germany with a 3-2 win over Chile, though, again, they concede an early goal. Robbo, what's the biggest challenge for Didier Deschamps?
Slight complacency, I would imagine, with the players, because they're a good side. They're an excellent side. When you look at the players they've got available to them, you look at the midfield, at the Tchouameni, who I think is a very good holding midfield player, Camavinga, we know he's got that energy to break forward. They've got Mbappe, Moani, who I thought was excellent in the game.
He needs to be excellent because he's not been excellent of late.
He certainly hasn't, but he was excellent in that game. Dembele, obviously, is another player that can come in. I think their problem could be defensively.
He doesn't like William. They have a million centre-backs, but I was shocked. Saliba played in this game, but he'd come out like, well, you know, Saliba, I forget the exact words he used, but he's like, well, you know, he does some things that I don't like, and so he has some deficiencies relative to the other guys. I'm paraphrasing here, Didier.
Yeah.
It seems like an odd thing to say in public.
So maybe that's the one weakness for France, the central defensive area. Speaking of Olivier Giroud, he's expected to make his choice in the next few days. Is he going to go and join Hugo Lloris at LAFC or stay another year at Milan? What would you advise?
So Giroud, of course, scored again, France's all-time leading goal scorer.
Good finish.
Possibly France's most handsome player ever as well. I don't know. Certainly probably most handsome center forward. To be honest, if he's happy with a part-time role, spend another year in Milan. I think he's grown up enough to understand that it's going to be a limited role because Milan have to start planning for the future and they are pursuing different strikers. He'll play more in LA. He's not going to get the buzz of those Champions League nights out there unless it's a CONCACAF Champions League. So
and he still scores goals, even if he uses his mobility, which he's lost over the last two or three years. He's still going to score goals when the ball comes in the box.
I think he's one of those like guys. We saw this from Zlatan towards the end of his career where, obviously they're not going to have the stamina and everything, but like in terms of agility, it hasn't gone away. I don't know if all these guys took up yoga or something, but he looks really good.
He can still jump. He can still move his body. Yeah, it's good.
Argentina go down to Costa Rica before coming back with three second-half goals from Angel Di Maria. gorgeous free kick. Alexis McAllister and Lautaro Martinez. Rabo, the world champions, could have scored more if not for some stunning work from Keylor Navas, who never plays.
He never plays, but he played well in this game. There was a lot of shots in the first half. He made good decisions on whether to punch or catch. He made several excellent saves. And Argentina created lots of chances. Garnacho was playing on the left-hand side. There was a lot of cutbacks for players in and around the box. Eventually McAllister got his goal. There was, as you said, a brilliant free kick from Di Maria, and Lautaro Martinez with a good finish after De Paul had just played the ball to him. So it was a good enough performance from Argentina without being brilliant, and well played Navas.
Who needs that Messi guy?
Yeah. Now Inter defender Francesco Acerbi was acquitted of using racist language towards Napoli's Juan Jesus. Gab, they didn't say he didn't do it, they just said they couldn't prove it. Is that right?
Yeah, pretty much. And this is what makes the whole thing so kind of yucky and uncomfortable. Mm. It's one person's view against another. Mm. This was not a criminal or civil proceeding. This was sporting justice. So yeah. What that means is the threshold is lower. You don't have to prove it beyond a reasonable doubt. You just have to prove it on the balance of probabilities, which is a term that we haven't heard in a footballing context since the Evra Suarez thing. And they concluded on the balance of probabilities. You know, we can't prove that Acerbi used that language. Juan Jesus is very upset about this. As I've said before, I think both men have handled this really, really badly. Jesus saying, well, we should just stay on the pitch. We shouldn't talk about him. I'm like, I'm sorry. Once you go to the referee and tell him, you know, of course they will investigate. Mm. Acerbi for not saying anything until much later. It's an ugly thing. I don't want to see this again. But I can't think of a better way to adjudicate this when it's one person's word against another, and there's no witnesses. Mark Ogden reports that Manchester United want to talk to Wolverhampton Wanderers' Gary O'Neill, though not necessarily for a head coach role. They're going to bring him in for specialist media advice on how to change a subject when you lose to Coventry and go and make it all about poor Mark Robbins shouting. No, just kidding. I'm sorry, Gary. Robbo, what would they have in mind for Gary O'Neill? Why would he want to leave a job where he's a manager and has a 3-year contract to, if it's not for the manager's job at United, which I'm thinking he's not going to get?
No, I suppose it would be to be under a manager, be the assistant head coach.
Coach is normally like assistants who they've worked with before and who they know and trust.
And also, I can't see why on earth he would move from Wolves, where he's doing a good job, apart from the cup semi, the quarterfinal against Coventry. He seems to have got the crowd right behind him. He's doing well, he's making all the decisions. Why would you go and be somebody else's assistant? I don't quite get that. Now, Xavi has had his appeal over the 2-game suspension he received in Barcelona's win over Atletico turned down. You okay with that, Gab?
I am, because look, as much as I adore Xavi, he's had a million yellow cards. You need to keep his cool. This is a game that they ended up winning, what, 3-0?
Yep.
And he gets himself sent off after half an hour. No, spend some time to reflect on this and don't do it again. Because guess what? Managers shouting and losing their rag on the sidelines generally does not influence the referee to give you calls.
No.
Bild in Germany are reporting that Brighton's Roberto De Zerbi has been told he's the plan B if they fail to secure Xabi Alonso as their next manager. Would he be a good fit, Robbo?
Would he be a good fit? I'm not 100%. I like his coaching. I like the style of the way his teams play. Would he be a good manager of big players? I'm unsure about that, because I haven't seen him work with the really big players. I think he's an outstanding coach, and if they have their interview and feel as though he's got a great plan for them.
Ewan Ferguson, not big enough for you? What is he, like 6'3"?
he's a big character, but not that big. So I'm not sure about it. I would be.
I think it does show that they want to play that kind of progressive attacking football.
Yeah, I understand that.
But
he takes a lot of risks. But if they've got very good players, you can play that. And that could be the turning point for him. Now, Nottingham Forest have announced they will appeal the 4-point penalty over violations of profit and sustainability regulations. Not a surprise, really, is it, Kev?
No, it's not a surprise that they're going to appeal. Why wouldn't you appeal, right? They could also be heard before the end of the season. There are some very good explainers out there on the nitty-gritty about why they feel that they have a good case to at least reduce it. If you go online, you can go check them out. I mean, in a nutshell, it's to do with the fact that they're basically, because they were in the second division, their monitoring period is different. They sold Brennan Johnson, but they sold him after June 30th. So obviously, if you count him, and there's other factors. I think they have a case. Whether they'll go for it or not, I don't know. Fabrizio Romano, or as you might call him, Fabrizio Romano, reports that Toni Kroos has agreed to stay at Real Madrid for another year, and an announcement is imminent. Makes sense to you, Robbo?
Yes, because he's playing well enough to warrant another year. He's still dominating games. Real Madrid have got plenty of pace in the forward areas. They've got pace elsewhere in the side. So although he's not great defensively, he's not got great mobility, he can still run a game when the opposition sit deep. Those crossfield passes to Carvajal or Lucas Vazquez is still causing teams a problem. So I can understand why he would stay another year.
Yeah, I think minutes are going to be the big thing. And yeah. So, but, you know, he's kind of sharing minutes this year with Modric.
He's playing more than Modric, I would say.
Yeah, he's played more. Modric less happy about it. Obviously, Modric also substantially older than Kroos.
Yeah.
You wouldn't keep both of them, would you?
No. I mean, I think Modric has had his day, probably. Now, former Spanish FA president Luis Rubiales is facing a 2.5-year prison sentence as a result of that unwanted Jenny Hermoso kiss and its aftermath, Gab.
Yeah, so I think I just want to be clear about this. This is what the prosecution is asking for, obviously.
Yeah.
You're going to have a trial if it does go to trial, and then they're going to decide. So normally the prosecution doesn't get everything they want. What I think is interesting here is, you know, the 12 months of sexual assault, people might say this is not a sexual assault, but I think more serious, and it shows is more serious, is 18 months for coercion, for intimidation, for all the silly stuff that happened afterwards with the statements that were changed and so on, stories of pressure, of intimidation, of witnesses. That, to me, I'm not minimizing the first part, but that, to me, is why this part of it, the 18 months, why that is longer. Because this is abuse of power,
yes,
to a degree that I think is worrying and really unbecoming. Again, if proven. Jurgen Klopp's right-hand man Pep Leinders is reportedly in the running to take over Ajax next season. Robbo, he's 41 years old. He was at Liverpool, then he went away to Nijmegen, didn't really work out, came back to Liverpool. Klopp obviously thinks the world of him. Klopp's obviously leaving, in case you hadn't noticed, at the end of the year, so that he's going to move on too. But I find it really hard, viewing from the outside, how do you judge how good an assistant is? You kind of have to go by hearsay, what people tell you, right?
Well, exactly. And everybody will have to go by what Klopp tells them and what the players tell whoever wants him, Ajax. Because you can't tell what somebody's like. Because you could be a great assistant coach. You can be a great trainer, coach out on the field, but you're not making the big decisions. You haven't got to tell a player you're not playing today. That's the manager's job, and that's when you see whether a manager or a person, a head coach or an assistant coach, can do the job as a manager until he becomes the manager. It's a massive risk. Arteta, when he first went to Arsenal, I'm not sure that was the right move. Oh, I didn't think it was the right move, but he's proved over the last couple of years that it maybe was, and he learned his things from Pep.
It's interesting. I was wondering, I mean, the people who know best whether Leinders is ready to step up at a big club are the people at Liverpool.
Yes.
Right? By all accounts, it's not an option. And I can understand why Leinders would want to move on when his mentor Klopp moves on as well. But I really think Ajax, you go back to the previous managers Ajax had, and they've kind of been all over the shop, but It is kind of a gamble. I mean, he is 41. I'm just wondering whether he wouldn't be better off with some intermediate role before going to a club of Ajax's magnitude.
Yeah, and if Klopp's going to go back into work at some point, and whether he just goes, as you say, into an intermediate job to start with, and then goes back with Klopp when he gets another role.
Do we know Klopp's going to go back into work?
I would imagine he's going to work at some point, surely. He's not going to just leave it.
I don't know. I'm just. Who knows? He can do what he obviously.
Well, Pep said he's going to come back because he loves it. So
exactly.
So if Pep says it, must be right. Now, Dani Alves has been released from prison after handing in his passports and paying a €1 million bond. But Gab, there's a mystery over actually who paid it.
Yeah. So the assumption was that, you know, Neymar's family would do it. Mm. They came out very, very strongly and said, because obviously they've supported him with his legal costs before. And by the way, the reason Dani Alves, I always have to repeat this, the reason Dani Alves can't pay for his own legal costs and his own bond is he doesn't have the, his accounts are being frozen because he's got a paternity suit and alimony sort of child support case pending against him in Brazil and elsewhere. So all his accounts are frozen, right? And again, in case you mentioned, he was sentenced to in prison for rape. He is appealing it. Part Neymar's people said, look, he's been found guilty. I know he's got a right to an appeal, but we're not going to go and pay to have somebody released who's been found guilty. Mm. Fair enough. A strong suggestion that Memphis Depay put up the money for him, but Depay's people have said, no, it's not us. We're not going to do that. I wonder why we can't be told, why this has to be a secret, who paid for Dani Alves to get out. It could also be something totally unsexy, which we in the media haven't emphasized, is Dani Alves' accounts may be frozen, but it's not like he's got assets all over the world. It's not like they're going to be taken away forever. So it really shouldn't be that difficult for a lawyer to go to a bank and say, hey, you know, see this $3 million house that Dani Alves has God knows where. It's frozen, but we'll put it up as collateral. Mm. Because it's not like his entire net worth will be taken away when the other case, if you see what I'm saying, right? So, it's just such an ugly story. They took his passports away because they consider him a flight risk, incidentally, which
isn't not great, is it?
Richarlison opened up in an interview with ESPN Brazil and revealed that he coped with depression and entertained thoughts of death. He says this was after Brazil got knocked out from the World Cup in 2022. He says that getting therapy, working with a psychologist has really helped him. Robert, somebody being so open about mental health while still a player, it's something that would have been unthinkable, not just in your day, but I think even just 10 years ago.
Absolutely. It was almost thought of as you were being weak.
You're showing
weakness. That's what managers would have thought. That's what the crowd would have thought. Other players would have thought. You know, you get on with it. And there would have been lots of players with mental issues. You know, everybody coped with football in a different way, and coping when you didn't play quite so well, coping with injury, all those sort of things, coping with the crowd giving you some stick. Everybody would have had mental issues at some point, but you just couldn't tell anybody because that was seen as a weakness, and the manager might not even play. Oh, well, he's a weak character, you know, so we won't play him in the team. So
you've witnessed this, yeah?
Oh, I've witnessed it many, many times. And I would say when I had my injury problems and was out for 2 years, I had to go through mental issues and see a psychologist to try and build my confidence back up, to get myself back out and playing again. Because you're never quite sure when you've been out for 2 years.
But then when people found out you went to see a psychologist, they're like, oh, why is Robbo doing this?
But I did it for, not for mental issue, I did it for building my confidence back up.
Right, that's still a mental aspect, right?
Yeah, so it was, and going back over my previous, you know, it's just, I had to do little things like look at paper clippings of you playing 2 years ago. What was that saying about you then? What was that? You haven't changed. You've just been injured for 2 years. So there's lots of different things that players would have done, but it would have seen as a weakness.
Yeah, I mean, look, there's a much broader sort of piece about male mental health in general, beyond sport and beyond football. But while Richarlison, especially if you're playing against him, might not always be the most likable character, I mean, big props, big credit for him. There is a macho culture out there which still endures. And to have someone in the prime of his career come out and be so open to it, hopefully it empowers
most others. Players hid it. That was what I would say.
Yeah, they hide it. But you know what? If you get help, the reason you do this is to get coping mechanisms so that you can get on to do your job.
You're almost being taught to cope with the problems.
I think that's it. It's not like you go into therapy and like, look, you're cured. Mm. You know, Richarlison's fine now. No, he may be, he may not be, but it's been encouraging people to go and talk about this so they can get the things that they can overcome, these daily obstacles. Mm. I mean, that's what it's all about.
Remember Gabriel Barbosa, AAK Gabigol. He's been banned for 2 years for obstructing a doping test.
How could I possibly forget Gabigol, former Inter star Gabigol, who came to symbolize a whole generation of futility at Inter. Obviously, he's turned his career around since then, did very well at Flamengo over the years. This is a very weird story to me, and just going on what was written in the Reuters report that I read, I think he has a very strong case. So apparently what happened is a surprise drug test at the training ground. And they come by and all his teammates get tested. And I don't know if he was like making himself scarce in the back. He didn't actually get tested until hours later, right? I mean, he was still there on location. When he did get tested, he tested negative. But the ban for obstructing or refusing a doping test you know, there are tough bands for it. So he got 2 years. He's going to appeal this, and they're also going to make the argument that, look, you could have given him a blood test, so it's not a case of him just going to the bathroom and urinating out whatever you think he might have taken. A blood test would have kind of ascertained whether he was clean or not. This is what the lawyers are saying, obviously. But you didn't do that. So it's almost like you wanted to catch it, right? Of course, that begs the question, why didn't he go and get his own independent blood test so he could maybe prove something? But it's an odd story, and it's a blow for him and for Flamengo. You know, he's been through a lot. Jose Mourinho says that he misses management and is hoping to be back this summer. He didn't rule out Saudi Arabia, saying Cristiano Ronaldo had opened the doors to the world. Now he likes Cristiano again. I, however, get the feeling that he wants to stick around Europe. What sort of club would suit him, Robbo?
I'm not sure there's too many clubs that would suit him at the moment. Chairman would look at the problems that he poses as an individual, the style of football that he plays, and he hasn't moved with the times, I wouldn't say. He's going to cost you a lot of money. So I'm not sure there's... And he would want to go to a club that's got a chance of winning things. I don't think there's too many of those clubs in Europe that would take him for the amount of money he would want. So Saudi Arabia, for me, would be his only option.
I would hope Mourinho at this stage isn't really motivated by money. He turned down Saudi before, of course. I think from his time at Roma, he formed a connection with the fans. Mm. He filled the stadium. He got them super excited. Obviously, he got them to 2 European finals. Mm. Playing a style of football that maybe you don't like.
But also, he didn't do particularly well in Serie A.
He did poorly in Serie A. Yeah. But what I'm wondering is, in light of that, might his position be maybe a Champions League club that's maybe outside the Big Five that maybe says, you know, let's go on a run in Europe with somebody who is kind of a specialist.
Do you think he is an inspirational character as he once was?
100%. 100%, okay. Right? A club that, in the right context, right? Mm. He showed that at Roma. While also doing a bunch of other things that I didn't agree with and I thought were just silly and counterproductive. But it would have to be a club like that, but also then a club where he takes a step back and then he doesn't get the fat paycheck he got and maybe also doesn't go and, you know, make all the demands about signing players and money and whatever. I think he can get that kind of job. I think he can do really well in a knockout because he's a knockout competition guy now. I think he'd do well with the national team as well. Not maybe not Portugal, obviously the job's not open, but you know, if he gets the lift, the connection, you know, there are other options for him. But yeah, he probably
I'd love to see the old Jose Mourinho back in football, the one that we saw at Chelsea, the one that we saw at Porto, the one we saw for Real Madrid for a little while. You know, because that's when he was at his very best, and he was magnificent in those times. He needs to get back to that. No surprises in the first two women's Champions League return legs as Chelsea and Barcelona both go through, Gab.
Yeah, I think this was kind of obvious from the first legs because they had big leads. Chelsea just drawing 1-1 with Ajax. Lyon beating Benfica 4-1. They got more games tonight. But again, Barcelona and Paris Saint-Germain, you know, heavily favored from the first legs. It looks like the semifinals, if all goes to plan, will be French derby, Paris Saint-Germain against Lyon, and Chelsea against Barcelona, rematch of a Women's Champions League final a few years ago, which
should
I
be
think
good.
Is pretty exciting. I mean, more so than this round of games, which were all kind of over after the first leg. Manchester City have signed the Philadelphia Union's Kevin Sullivan for what some are saying is the largest fee ever for a homegrown MLS player. Now, I'm very skeptical about that because the largest fee for a homegrown MLS player ever paid is $20 million. That was Ricardo Pepi to Augsburg. And this guy, Kevin Sullivan, he doesn't even turn 15 until September. Okay, he's 14 years old. And that's why he's reportedly going to stay in Philadelphia until he's old enough to move to Europe, but probably when he's 18, maybe 16. But how do you even begin to assess what a 14-year-old is going to be like as an adult, that you can put a number on it?
It's very, very difficult. You know, you know that a player's got potential. You can see that he's got a football brain. You can see that he's always going to be a good athlete. You can tell that he's got great technical ability, that he's outstanding in his age group and he's much better than everybody else. But you don't know what's going to happen to a player mentally when they start playing at a higher level. You know, there's been lots of players, and I've coached players, where we always thought, oh, that young player is going to get to the top. And then as he got further forward, the mentality side of it wasn't quite so good. And he didn't like when things didn't quite go his way, because he'd always been lauded. So it's a very, very difficult thing to do, to say a player's going to be magnificent and he should be worth that amount of money. But then we've been talking about Yamal, who's only a year and a half older. I think you'd pay $20 right. million for him now, wouldn't you? Because you can see what he's done at the top.
Yeah, no, what it was, Lamine Yamal's been there and done that so far in La Liga.
Yeah.
You know, this guy, I think he played for, like, the Philadelphia Union Reserves, or a mixture of professionals and amateurs. Otherwise, he does play two age groups above him.
Yeah.
Which I think, and he does have an older brother who's a professional footballer, and his dad, I think, is a coach. Do these things help?
I think those things help. You know, if you look at Jude Bellingham, I think everybody knew at 14, 15, he was going to be one of the England's best players. We didn't know he was going to go on to be a world-class player. So they would have...
So you can tell at that age.
You can tell at that age that they have got the ability, the outstanding ability, and probably the mentality to take them to the very top. You don't know what knockbacks might give them might cause them a problem or two over the course of the next couple of years.
It's an interesting one, because while I believe he has an EU passport, obviously he's not allowed to come to Europe until he's 16. And I actually think, I mean, he can't come to Manchester City until he's 18. Technically, right?
I'll give you another example. You mentioned many, many times to me Martin Ødegaard. You know, I said, well, how can you pay that for him? He said, he's an outstanding player. He'll do well. He'll be a top-class player. Well, he's proved to be right. So the money spent on him was probably well worth it.
Eventually.
Yeah.
But I'm just wondering, would Ødegaard, if Real Madrid had said, all right, you're just staying here, would he be the player he is now?
Probably
or were those
not.
Steps with the loans and everything, was that a necessary...
I think that was a necessary thing, to see what he did elsewhere, to see whether he could play it in men's football and still perform at a very high level. It didn't quite work out for him at Real Madrid, but he's done brilliantly at Arsenal over the last couple of years.
Yeah, I don't know, I don't think it's as bad as it was a few years ago in terms of going after 14-year-olds, 15-year-olds, other than obviously kids who are... Mm. Or local, like I'm assuming, you know, here in London, we've got what, like 14 professional clubs, and I'm sure they're always looking at each other, and maybe, you know, people do switch academies and stuff. I think that's calmed down a little bit, right, with the new regulations.
A little bit, but then remember with Arsenal, when they, at one point, they were going to get every player from Barcelona and paying quite a lot of money for them, you know, so...
You know, Cesc Fabregas 20 years ago.
Yeah, and Gael Clichy and people like that. Yeah, they were, not Gael Clichy, there's a couple of others. But they were paying a lot of money to bring players at 16. You know, people say, oh, well, they came through Arsenal's system, or they came through that youth team system.
Yeah,
they didn't really, they were bought at 16. Sticking with Major League Soccer, Gab... The referee lockout is over and the league can now have proper officials.
So obviously, as somebody who likes unions and believes workers should be represented, I am pleased that they were able to reach a deal. I think it's ridiculous. Again, if you haven't followed the story, the referees union, they wanted a raise. And so MLS said while they're negotiating, they couldn't reach a collective bargaining deal. So MLS basically said, all right, we don't need you guys. And so they went and they found other referees, youth referees, college referees, randos who they got, like, you know.
Did that work out well?
So a lot of teams were unhappy with this. I don't think it worked out great. I think you kind of have a problem. I think this is a situation where the Football Association, I mean, obviously USSF not as strong as football internally as football associations are elsewhere. But I always said, like, listen, you want to be a Division I program? You want to maintain this? You have to have real referees. You can't go and get a bunch of random people because you're sending a message.
Yeah,
right. Referees are not important, right? I'll get Joe from the hot dog stand to run the line, and you know, Freddie the producer can stumble around.
Apparently, Freddie the producer is a good referee.
I'm sure he's a wonderful referee. And also, the other thing is the amounts of money. Under the new deal, so they received a raise where experienced referees go from making $86,000 a year to $142,000 a year, and linesmen go from $19,000 a year to $37,000 a year, which, incidentally, I'm not sure, you know, considering your career last 15, 20 years, all these people must have second jobs,
the linesmen,
at a minimum. So, you know, I'm glad this is over. I think it's pretty embarrassing that you had this situation. I think what they probably should have done is, okay, we can't reach a deal. There's a lockout or a strike, you know, if you want to look at the flip side of it, although this was technically a lockout, then you bring in referees from other countries. But you can't just say, this is not an important part of the game. Mm. You're expendable. Ha ha, we'll show you, right? Which seems to be the attitude with which they went into this.
Very dangerous.
Luxury hospitality is all the rage in football, Robbo. Fulham are planning to build an area with a bar and a swimming pool overlooking the Thames on their refurbished riverside stand at Craven Cottage. Your thoughts?
It'd be like home for home when you go there, wouldn't it? Because you live in that sort of area. You've got a swimming pool on top of your luxury apartment.
Yeah, but
apartment.
Mine's covered. This one wouldn't be.
Oh, okay, it's true.
And we have a retractable. This is what I don't understand. You're still in London. Like, you don't need the swimming pool. Like, who's, like, other
not
than...
Not on a match day, surely.
Well, that's what... But you know what? I think the novelty of it, if they can make more money... For me, the big thing is, I don't want to see fans gouged.
No.
If somebody likes the experience, you know, once in a lifetime, I'm going to go to Craven Cottage and, you know, drop $2,000 or $5,000 or whatever it is, sure. Knock yourself
out. I can imagine you're going to be in there at some point.
In the swimming pool, yeah.
Yeah. Gab, I know you love Jorge Sampaoli. What do you make of the story regarding his lost wallet?
Okay, so first of all, I don't even know if this story is true. Sampaoli was most recently seen at Flamengo before he got fired. But the newspaper, Diario de Sevilla, obviously he was in Seville before, reports a story about how he kind of lost his man bag, and a good Samaritan returned it to him. And they were, despite the fact that there were 12,000 euros in cash inside, which is about $15,000. And I'm wondering, if I lost my man bag with $15,000, I would not want somebody to return it to me and tell the story about how they returned it with all this money, because I'm trying to imagine, why would you possibly have
all that money?
Assuming you're not a drug dealer, assuming you haven't just walked out of a casino, assuming what you
possibly... How much have you got in your wallet at the moment?
Sorry?
How much have you got in your wallet?
I don't carry cash anymore. I have a phone, dude. What? Like, honestly. But, like... No, why would you ever have, what do you ever need that kind of money for? No. Maybe he's throwing himself a party with friends who he has to pay to hang out with?
No.
Whatever.
Idea.
I'll leave it there. Robbo, thank you so much for stepping
Always
in.
Always a pleasure, Gav. Always a pleasure.
Jules away on Monday again on assignment. But don't worry, because we have Dandy Don Hutchinson joining us. Until then, love the game, love your neighbor, love yourself.